In May 1841, the first camera arrived in Australia. How and why it got here is a story we'll explore in a moment, but right from the beginning, this miraculous new technology was put to work in the colonial project, promoting the country, its settlement, its land and its people, white and black, savage and civilised. Cameras in those very early years recorded the world with an accuracy people had never known before. And the images that survive, my next guest writes, are more than delicate artefacts. They have great historical power. The stories they tell persist. Elisa De Corsi is a curator, historian and author of a new book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia, published by Melbourne University Press. Elisa joins me from Canberra. Elisa, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, David. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us the story of that first camera and how it reached Australia.
Oh, well, it's a rollicking tale, really, and one without a lot of design. So as most listeners will probably know, the invention of photography is not something that happened in Australia. It happened in France and Britain, and it's a series of kind of discoveries and experimentations, processes of experimentation that are refined and then patented and then commercialized. And these happen in the late 1830s. Around 1839, there's a commercial unveiling of a process called the daguerreotype, which is the first real kind of photographic process that has commercial uptake. And a camera leaves France on a educational vessel, actually, an Ecole Flottante, which is an expedition chartered by a person called Captain Augustine Lucas. And he is in charge of taking a crew of essentially upper middle class pupils around the world with a ship full of teachers and maritime professionals as a form of, I guess, enlightenment education. And aware of the discussions about photography happening in France, Captain Lucas visits the French inventor of photography, Louis-Jacques Mordeguer's studio in Paris. And along with ecclesiastical tutor Louis Comte, he acquires a camera, plates and chemistry. Now, this is kind of a very long story, but essentially the vessels he's on, L'Orient, leaves France just as the big unveiling of photography is happening in France, and it sails down the African coast, crosses the Atlantic, and pictures are kind of taken along the way. It progresses further south, down the South American coast, and then is up to the harbour at Valparaiso in Chile. In June 1840, and it's scheduled to keep on going up the American West Coast line before crossing the Pacific and heading to the Philippines. But there's a big shipwreck when it leaves Valparaiso Harbour on the 23rd of June 1840, and this whole expedition, which I should say at this point has had international attention in the press, is disbanded, and it's kind of comes to a terminal end in Valparaiso when the ship runs aground while leaving the harbour and kind of crashes on the escarpment of the lighthouse. But what happens then is that Captain Lucas, with the daguerreotype camera and the remaining plates and the chemistry, is forced to think about how he gets himself back to France. And he is part of a maritime family, and he has a brother who's a merchant captain on another ship. And it's on this ship, the Justine, that is shuttling across the Pacific, that Lucas brings the camera and the plates into Wawaran, Sydney Harbour in March 1841. So it's really an accident.
No, it's a series of disasters.
Yes, it's definitely, well, but very kind of, I mean, I call it quite traumatic, but that shipwreck in terms of 19th century shipwrecks is, you know, everyone escapes with their life. I mean, the plates are intact, the camera's intact.
It's a very civilized shipwreck.
Yeah.
And it brings us the camera. And what is the response of Sydney to the arrival of this camera?
Well,
wonder, enthusiasm, excitement?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have a whole chapter that I call Arrivals, because I feel like this is one contender for the arrival of photography in colonial Australia, but it's definitely not the only one. And I think the thing about Lucas's expedition is that really news of his shipwreck and news of the the school vessel being run aground in Valparaiso actually makes its way to Sydney before Lucas and the camera does. So people know that the L'Oriental has been shipwrecked in Valparaiso, and it's this kind of the hype around this expedition that kind of translated across the news in the British and French worlds, and then its kind of unglamorous end, which precedes Lucas. So he arrives somewhat shamed, I think that's fair to say, and the camera is kind of like incidental. And I think this is important to know, that in 1841, in March, people are hearing about photography in colonial Australia.
They hadn't seen anything.
No. So there is no record of a photographic image arriving before this camera. There's no opportunity to have a picture taken. And I think it is very hard for people to understand, to have the language to understand what photography is. So the camera is set up for a demonstration, and I think this is such a poetic moment. The journalist who comes to cover the event calls the issuing picture a beautiful and minute sketch, because there is no language to talk about that kind of indexical fidelity of the photographic image. There's no vocabulary to describe it yet.
Elisa, what was it of? What was the photograph of?
Yes. Oh, well, that's a great question, David. Well, the demonstration of the camera is set up outside a merchant storehouse, and Lucas is actually trying to sell the camera because he needs to pay for his passage back to France. And he's not having any luck selling the camera as an inert object, so he sets up this idea of a demonstration. And it is of the streetscape at Macquarie Place. But we don't have the photograph. We only have accounts of the photograph being taken. There is no surviving picture, and the camera remains unsold. So when I talk about this event in the context of the book, I really use it to kind of describe a false start in the practice of colonial photography, because we have a camera, we have someone who might know how to use it, but we have a description of an image that doesn't survive and definitely doesn't have any publicity around it after that event. It's not put in someone's shop window. It's not taken by someone. It's, you know, it's not of someone. So it kind of disappears, and that camera remains unsold for 3 years. So it's an arrival of a technology, but not the beginning of a practice.
There's something terribly Australian about that.
Yeah, well, I guess what I try and discuss is that, you know, all these things are being engineered in, you know, Europe. So photography is foreign, and it relies on the kind of confluence of a number of different things. You have to have the technical skill to take a picture. Then you need the equipment, but then you need it also to kind of be cared for and looked after somewhere for the image to survive. So it's only really when those three things align and people start using photography in a purposeful way that you get a practice coalescing.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Elisa De Corsi about her book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia, which has just appeared, published by Melbourne University Press. Elisa, what's the earliest photograph we have taken on the Australian continent?
Oh, surviving today, you mean? In 2025?
That's what I mean by surviving. Now.
Oh, it is such a tricky question. You want to see it? Well, it's one that gets trundled out a lot. It's of William Bland, and it comes from the first commercial studio run by George Baron Goodman, and it is in Sydney, and it's from 1845. So it's, it's almost 4 years after that camera demonstration we were just talking about. But I think if I could just like take a beat at that point, This book that I've written and researched is the first kind of substantial study of early photography in colonial Australia, a two-decade period from the 1840s to the 1860s. And I think why this period hasn't received a lot of attention more broadly is because the quantity of images that we have from it is so small, but we have a whole lot of other source material which tells us about the kind of bulk of images that were being produced. So I'm going to talk about William Bland's photograph, which is in the State Library of New South Wales, and they routinely bring it out for exhibition. And it's this kind of
And I've got it. I've got it in front of me now. It's on page 30 in your book. Yes.
But so Goodman, the photographer, had an almost decade-long practice in colonial Australia, and we have less than a dozen images from his commercial studio surviving in Australian collections. But we know he made thousands of photographs. And we know this because we look at things like when he spent 4 months in Melbourne, the papers recorded how much money he made, and that was £870 in 4 months. Now, his daguerreotypes, a six-plate daguerreotype was £1, 1 shilling. So
a
you
guinea.
can imagine how the bulk of photographs that are produced in this period are not equivalent to what we have surviving today.
Oh, but at least they're there. They're out there somewhere. They're in a box somewhere. They are in somebody's cupboard. They don't know what they are and how valuable they are. They are going to turn up, I know. I'm completely confident they have to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it points to a few things. It points to how people used photographs in the colony, and those people who could afford to commission portraits often sent them away overseas. So one of the great writers of Australian photography, Helen Ennis, says it might be just as possible to do a project like this in England or Scotland or Ireland because there'll be lots of Australian photographs there. But the other point is, and I was actually just talking about this with Helen this morning, the other point is like how to find them. And lots of these images, you know, they don't have really obvious traces with them unless you read them as part of like next to letters and diaries. So you've got to recontextualize them in the kind of worlds of colonial image making they're a part of. And that's really what this book is about.
Tell people who Helen Ennis is because she matters.
Oh, Helen. She's written very widely about the history of photography. She's a biographer, and I guess she wrote in the early 2010s that, you know, this is the big gap in Australian photographic history, that no one's really written a substantial history of photography's arrival. And so in a kind of...
You've done the job.
Well, I've done the first go.
You've done the job. Alisa, can I say about the photograph of Dr. William Bland? It's a completely modern face. And that's what I find so moving about early photography. The moment you get this detailed perfection, the face is modern. That man could have wandered in off the street today.
Yeah. I mean, that is the beauty, like the material beauty of the daguerreotype process, is that it really is so sensitive to light that it's really capturing that very minute detail, detailed and minute sketch, like the reporter called it. But it's, you know, you can zoom in on these pictures, and in a lot of the images reproduced in the book, I actually include sections. So the photograph of William Bland, you know, it is a tiny image. It's meant to be held in the palm of your hand. It's small. But then the detail, the richness of detail in the image, if you look at the pupils in his eyes, you can see the window of the room reflected back in them. And I think this is actually something that you can't really see to the naked eye. But if you see a detailed digital image of the William Bland daguerreotype, you can then zoom in to the detail of his pupils. And I think that's an incredible kind of, you know, the detail has to be there in the historic image for you to see it, but it is definitely part of the research process that's enabled in the contemporary space.
People were photographed, but also landscape. Why was landscape photographed?
Oh, I mean, I think the real reason that this book is called Colonial Photography is because you can't have photography in this place if you don't re-embed it in the colonial history. In, you know, the camera arrives in 1841, as we talked about, the year after transportation ends, and the whole structure of society and politics in colonial Australia is shifting away from this narrative of penal settlement to colonial society and society by conquest. And photography is kind of actually really co-opted in a very obvious way to celebrate that conquest. So it chronicles the construction of cities, towns. I mean, the first outdoor photographs are taken on the steps of studios looking out, and they're on main streets, high streets, and it's a celebration of we are building cities here. And it's a kind of redaction of country. So it's a redaction of the narratives of country that are willfully denied. And then as technologies improve, you have this marriage with urban photography and kind of photography of the quote-unquote wilderness or outer reaches of the urban space, where it is about kind of exploration or like capturing the natural world and celebrating that kind of quote-unquote untouched beauty. So it's really about...
And celebrating the possibilities of putting sheep into that country.
Definitely. It's about economic resources, timber. I mean, this is not unique to photography, of course. You know, other colonial artists are doing this. If we think of Eugène von Gérard's big albums of, the kind of untapped resources throughout the colony of Victoria, you know, there are... But photography kind of brings to it a kind of index. And I think the colonial landscape or the colonizing potential of the landscape really is emphasized when photographs enter the exhibition circuit, so the imperial exhibition circuit. So you have like hunks of timber or nuggets of gold next to the land, photographs of the land where those resources came from. So it's absolutely intertwined with processes of, colonizing and conquest.
When were the first images of Indigenous people?
I guess the first images of Indigenous people we have surviving today come from the studios of William Kilburn, and they are people, Kulin people who have been brought to the studios to have their photographs taken. But I think this is a really interesting and valuable period in kind of critically studying the history of photography, these decades of the 1840s and the 1850s, because it's just on the threshold of when photography is co-opted into the missionary enterprise. And all those uses of photography to articulate or to show civilizing potential or civilizing success, as it was discussed, it is before that. And I think there are slipperinesses in how First Nations people are photographed. And in the book I write about a particular encounter with the camera that Menang Noongar people had, which is people in Albany in the southwesterly corner of the Australian continent, and think about the kind of value of those images today. In 1858, a survey ship docked in Mamankaroot, King George's Sound, and it had two photographers on board, Arthur Onslow and James Glenn Wilson. And in 1858, so that's like, a decade and a half after that camera was demonstrated in Sydney, this is the first engagement of Menang Noongar people with photographic technologies. But, I went to Menang Karut and I talked with Menang people, and we looked at these photographs of ancestors. And what's really striking is that the engagement with the camera is set up, the survey ship, the Herald, which was docked in the Sound, had two photographers, like I mentioned, and it's firstly colonists who come and have their pictures taken by the photographers.
Yeah.
And we have the account of this in the diaries of colonists. And then... the Menang are given small payments and they pose for the camera. And they do this in traditional dress. And I was talking about these, what we can read from these images today, the value of these images today with the Menang people. And they have a seasonal and cultural legibility that wasn't captured at the time in the kind of letters and colonial archive. the Menang men are wearing bukas, which show the entrails of the flesh eaten away by the stretched kangaroo skin. So a buka is a stretched kangaroo cloak. And Memang wear the cloak with the fur side against their skin because it's quite blustery. And this is a practice of making bukas that happens in the high summer because the skins get stretched and they're out in the sun. And so the register of the entrails on the outward-facing side of the kangaroo skins tells us something about what time of year these photographs are taken. But what's really fascinating to me is that the Memang experience of photography isn't informed by, you know, hearing about photographic lectures or receiving photographs in the post or, you know, watching an earlier camera demonstration. It's informed by over two decades prior to the invention of photography about European explorers and colonists docking in Memang Karoo, King George's Sound, and the practices of cultural introduction that accompanied that. So what is happening in front of the camera is a display of cultural introduction. They have
because one of the figures, one of the figures is dressed in a European suit.
One of the figures, yes, is dressed in European suit.
But now look, we're going to fly from Menang because we've only got a second left, I'm afraid. There was another genre which I think still fascinates us very much today from early photography. The photograph of the captured criminal.
Okay, yes.
They're so powerful. Why were captured criminals photographed? You know, the cornered, the bush ranger in the cell. Why was it important for us to have those images?
Yeah, well, I guess bushranging is, it kind of shows the unwieldy and unpoliceability of the colonial frontier and the danger. And I guess photography acted as an element of surveillance in those spaces. Even though, you know, photographs aren't being taken of bushrangers in the midst of heists, it is this idea to be to identify the bushranger.
And to show that we've captured him.
And to show that we've captured him and to celebrate the police work around the capture. But I think that often backfires, as I write about Ben Hall. I mean, when the public is presented with Ben Hall's image, they think of him as the gentleman bushranger because he is photographed in the studio and he looks very gentlemanly because he has commissioned this portrait and it is the only picture that the police have access to. So they seize the photograph of Ben Hall from his own house, which he's commissioned, and they use it in their kind of, in their activities of surveillance, but they're using a studio picture, which is already conditioned as a middle-class entity.
He looks handsome. He looks beautiful. And when you see that photograph, well, certainly this was true for me, when I saw the photograph again in your book, I realise I've known that photograph all my life. It's one of the really sort of fundamental images of Australia.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, like, in the end, it's photography is part of the legend of violence around bushranging. I mean, I also talk about, you know, there's, you know, post-mortem photographs of bushrangers, and I don't really illustrate the book very much with those because I feel that's a bit ghoulish.
Oh, now don't be. Don't be squeamish.
But that idea of capture and demise and death is so pertinent to 19th century photography in so many ways.
Now, Elisa, I blame you for this. You mentioned in the end, you used the expression in the end, and we've reached the end. I'm so sorry. The time has run out. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
I've been talking to Elisa De Courcy, historian and curator at the Australian National University, about her new book, Early Photography in Colonial Australia. Now, look, it's not a great big picture book. It's not something to leave open on your coffee table. It's a book of thoughtful text and beautiful photographs, published by Melbourne University Press. This is Late Night Live.